Welcome, welcome, Mesh fam, to another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast. We're a podcast dedicating to bridging the gap between you, our wonderful listeners, and the fantastic, funky world of fungi.
Okay, everybody, welcome Nicholas P. Money. He's a gentleman of letters, a mycologist, and professor at the Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He is the author of a number of popular science books that celebrate the diversity of the microbial world. His latest book is titled The Selfish Ape, Human Nature and Our Path to Extinction. And yes, Nick, you've written many enticing books, and I'm so excited to talk about them. Do you want to talk about how you got into mycology to begin with?
Yeah, I suppose that's somewhat interesting in that I got seduced by mycology as an 18-year-old. I was fortunate enough to attend Bristol University in... I've actually got a problem with my cat here. I've got a cat that went... She's just scratching stuff. Anyway, we're going to continue here. maybe she'll add some... Get off my damn desk, you. This is crazy. Anyway, go away, Izzy. Getting back to my biography, yes, indeed. When I was 18 years old, I was fortunate enough to attend Bristol University in southern Britain, and almost the first lecture that I enjoyed as a biology student was by a professor called Mike Madeline, and I was just completely hooked upon his message, but also on him. He was such a charismatic teacher, and he just opened up a new world for me. I knew very little really about fungal biology before I embarked on my undergraduate studies. And it was really just so enlightening and inspiring. And then I spent, you know, more than, 35 years since that time then working as a professional mycologist. So I think we should never underestimate the power of a teacher to change someone's life.
That's incredible. I know you, a lot of your work has to do with fungal spores and spore dispersal. And I'm just curious, you know, I've heard many different numbers of how many spores are in our atmosphere. There was one source I read that there's 100,000 fungal spores per 1,000 liters of air. And I'm just curious, like, how many spores are released into the atmosphere every year?
Yeah, so the best estimates are based on, it's actually studies by atmospheric chemists, because fungal spores carry particular chemical signatures on their surface. And so that's the research that's led to these estimates. But there's this incredible figure of 50 million tons of fungal spores ejected into our atmosphere every year, which is an astonishing mass of spores when we consider just how tiny individual spores are. That relates to an Avogadroian number of particles. You know, it's an astonishing number of particles. If we think about that, if we spread those spores equally, evenly over the surface of the planet, that would mean that in each square millimeter, if you can think of a tiny column of air that runs from the surface of the planet up into the higher atmosphere, but there's 1,000 spores packed into every one of those little cylinders with that tiny volume. It's astonishing. I don't know of, but 50 million spores, huge numbers. Another way of looking at it, I remember doing this calculation that we can, if you think about that in terms of surface area, if we flattened out all those spores, that's a surface area that's equivalent to the continent of Africa.
Wow.
That means that there's this enormous surface for chemical reactions to occur, and that's really the basis of this idea that fungal spores might indeed affect the chemistry of the atmosphere, and particularly might affect the condensation of water within clouds.
Yeah, that is 12 digits of pounds converted 50 million tons. That's astronomical. So how are these people like actually using their chemistry to figure out what's in the air? I read something about mannitol and using it as a biotracer.
So mannitol is an example of a sugar alcohol, and there's not actually many things in biology that produce mannitol, but fungi certainly do. And mannitol is present on the surface of the spores of basidiomycete fungi, so including the mushroom-forming fungi, but also on the surface of ascomycete fungi, ascospores. And it turns out that it's a pretty good tracer for looking for spores in samples of in air samples, because there's really nothing else up there that's contributing mannitol to the chemical mix. And so that's really how we get this estimate of 50 million tons, which is actually probably lowballing it, because there's plenty of other spores. For example, conidia, the asexual spores produced by fungi, there's no evidence that they carry mannitol on their surface. And so we've got to add them also. So it may be that there's even more than 50 million tons of these particles flying around up there.
And where were these samples taken?
So most of that sampling was actually done in, the original work was done in South America. And so they were particularly looking above forest canopies. So spore concentrations up there are likely to be, well, they are much, much higher than one would find over the open ocean, for example. So we have to think about that 50 million tons of spores, but being spread over the entire surface of the planet to get these ideas of 1,000 spores per square millimeter and so forth. So in some places, in some locations where fungal activity is really rich, then the concentration of spores is going to be much, much higher than it is over particularly the open ocean, where there's probably very, very low levels of spores.
So let's talk about how do they get into the atmosphere. One mechanism is called the Bueller's drop. And so Bueller was known as the Einstein of mycology. Do you know how he got that name and what he contributed to the myco world?
Yeah, so it's Bueller's drop rather than Bueller in Ferris Bueller. But so it was, yeah, he's sort of my favorite mycologist, A.H.R. Bueller, Reginald Bueller. And so he worked in the first half of the 20th century. I'm not sure that I appended this name of the Einstein of mycology to him. There may have been somebody before me, but I certainly revere his work. He was an incredibly smart and a very creative investigator. He spent most of his career working in Manitoba at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg in Canada. And he published a 7-volume series of books called Researches on Fungi. I mean, the 7th volume was published posthumously. And in these books, he just detailed, he's a good writer, he's exquisitely well written. He detailed the experiments that he performed on fungi during his career, starting before the First World War in Canada with some of his early studies on fungal spores. And he was very, very interested in the basidiospores, so those produced by basidiomycete fungi, including the mushroom-forming species. But he carried that interest for decades, and so he's performing experiments with ever greater levels of sophistication, and he learned so much about fungal biology. But he was also a geneticist of sorts. He studied bioluminescence in fungi. He studied the development of mycelia. He looked at mating reactions and thus his interest in genetics. So his work was very broad in its compass. But indeed, he was the investigator that we associate with the formation of this droplet of fluid at the base of the basidiospore that we now call Bueller's drop. And he got most of, in what he wrote, in most of the experiments he performed, he got pretty close to understanding how the mechanism worked. But the details of that process were not solved until really just the last, within the last decade or so. And that was largely due to the introduction of high-speed video microscopy, cameras running at thousands of frames a second. We could finally actually see what was happening on the spore surface whereas Buller was actually just guessing what happened, but turns out he guessed right most of the time. Very, yeah. Very
I actually was reading one of your papers and saw video references, and I currently have it pulled up right now. And it seems like it's footage from the environmental electron microscopy, which is compelling in and of itself, like how you were able to bring this type of microscopy to the natural world. Do you have any idea how they obtained this footage?
Well, that was footage that we produced in my lab, right? So I had a wonderful doctoral student, Maribeth Hassett, who actually performed these experiments. So the nice thing about environmental electron microscopy is that you can work with wet samples. You don't have to dry and coat everything and put them on stubs before you do your work. So you can actually introduce spores, you know, directly after they've been released from a mushroom cap and put them into the sample chamber, and using the controls on the environmental scanning electron microscope, you can alter the temperature and relative humidity within the system, and then look at what's happening in real time, really on the spore surface. I don't know whether that sort of makes sense, but that's what we were doing with those experiments. We were looking at what happened in terms of the condensation of water on the spore surface as we changed the humidity of the air surrounding those spores. So it's really a lot of finesse with that environmental control enabled us to gain new insights into the way that these Basidiospores spores work.
That's really awesome. And for our listeners who don't really know quite what a Buller's drop is. I've been pronouncing it wrong. I've been calling it Buller's drop, but so thank you for that correction. So there's this liquid that, you know, produces on top of the spore. What exactly is that liquid doing? For our listeners who don't know what exactly is going on,
surely most listeners must have a thorough knowledge of the formation of Buller's drop. I mean, this is common knowledge at this point, I think, among members of Homo sapiens. So I suppose if there's one or two people out there that don't really grasp the details of this, I can make some suggestions about how it works. Now, people have to point out to me from time to time just how esoteric this stuff is. No, there are really only three people on Earth that think about these things. Yeah. Really? Oh, I guess that's true, isn't it? Buller's drop. So this takes us back to the mannitol, because the spores deposit mannitol on their surface. That mechanism isn't well understood, but there's mannitol on the surface of the spore. We know this because we can wash it from the surface of the spore and actually measure its presence. The mannitol actually acts in an hygroscopic fashion in that it promotes the condensation of water on the spore surface. And so in those images to which you refer, water is actually condensing then from a vapor phase, from a gaseous phase, in a liquid form on the surface of the spore and actually forming this beautiful perfectly spherical droplet on the spore surface. And the effect of this is to actually change the center of mass of the spore with the growth of that droplet. So it's really like somebody handing you a bucket of water. Your combined center of mass actually moves toward this bucket of water, actually. It's not very... I wish there was some more poetic...
that was good.
But anyway, so there's this change in the center of mass, and then actually what happens is when that Buller's drop reaches a critical size, it actually merges with fluid on the rest of the spore, and this happens within on the microsecond time scale, millionths of a second, and the droplet races over the spore surface and actually imparts momentum to the system, and so the spore actually kicks itself into the air. So this is how spores get off mushroom gills. And as I said, I mean, Buller figured out a good deal about the way that this must happen just by observations in real time, but he didn't have access to the incredible technology that we have in the 21st century and that we can actually see this, the way that this works. at the level of the individual spore, and using high-speed video microscopy, we can actually see the spore in the process of jumping off the gill surface.
So this is like a catapult. And we'll put infographics in the show notes so people can actually see what this Buller's drop looks like in for the launching of these spores. It's actually really, really cool. And the first time I saw it, I was blown away. And yeah, it's really, really cool.
So one thing that makes it really interesting, one thing that's always interested me, is there's really nothing else out there in nature that uses this mechanism of movement. It's a uniquely fungal mechanism. And that's interesting. It works so well for the fungi, but we don't really see anything else like it. We don't find any prokaryotes, bacteria, or archaea that move in this way, nor other single-celled eukaryotes, which is, it's interesting. So it seems to have evolved once in the ancestors of the Basidiomycete fungi, and it's been working very well for presumably a few hundred million years at this point, but it's intriguing. There's actually a kind of slime mold that uses something that's a little bit like this, but that's a stretch.
Interesting. So how much do spores rely on this mechanism to be dispersed? You know, of course, like wind might also be a vehicle for them, but say there was no condensation, how many of the spores would be left behind and not properly distributed?
Well, that's a good question, actually. So in very, very few of the spores would be distributed unless this mechanism operates. However, there's growing evidence for interactions between invertebrates, insects and other invertebrates, and mushrooms, and that they might be very important in dispersing spores, even spores of mushrooms. So that's a possibility that this would work anyway. But if you've got a mushroom that's actually standing, you know, that's got a stalk, it's got a stipe, and the mushroom cap is above the boundary layer of still air on the surface of the, or on the floor of the forest, yeah, the majority of these spores are getting airborne by using this Buller's drop mechanism to jump off the gill. And then what happens is, I mean, this only fires them a tiny, tiny different distance, just a few spore lengths, and then they drop between the adjacent gills, and then they're swept away longer distances by air. But I mean, there have been some neat experiments done over the years that have shown that an enormous number or a large proportion of the spores actually just are dumped beneath a mushroom. They fall and they don't move very, very far. But certainly some percentage are dispersed longer distances. I mean, this is actually probably one of the reasons that mushrooms are so fecund. They produce such enormous quantities of spores because very few of them are actually distributed very far from the parent. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I should mention too that, I mean, this is actually something that Buller, again, just speaking to his particular genius, he actually measured the rates of spore dispersal from mushrooms. And it would take a while to explain how he did that experiment, but he was looking at an individual patch of gill tissue and looking at how many spores were being released from there. And then he used that to calculate what was happening across all of the gill surfaces within a mushroom. And he reckoned that for a modest-sized fruit body, that 30,000 spores per second were being released from that structure, which is mind-boggling, isn't it? 30,000 spores a second. And then this is how, during the life of a mushroom, you're getting hundreds of billions of spores released over the course of a few days. It's really...
I can't wait for our technology to advance enough to get actual footage of that happening.
You can do it. I mean, this is
in a sense, but really, really close up would be super cool. Yeah.
I mean, if you're out in the woods, well, I don't know, you've been out collecting mushrooms and you're sitting on the deck of your cabin maybe late at night, and if you get out a flashlight and actually look beneath the mushroom and you just get the light just in the right direction, you'll see this fairy dust cast beneath the mushroom cap. It's absolutely beautiful. So yeah, and you can see this, as the see these particles, see this dust being dispersed You have to hold the mushroom in just the right angle and orient your flashlight in just the right direction, and you'll see this happening. Obviously not in detail, but yeah.
So I've heard of different cultivators, whether they're growing shiitake or some different types of mushrooms. I think shiitake was the most notable. They'll play thunder, kind of like music of rock and roll, or actual like a thunderstorm soundtrack, and they say that it increases yields dramatically. And I'm just curious, you know, you're talking about this mechanism of the Buller's drop and needing that condensation in the air to, you know, release these spores. And I'm just curious what your thoughts on the correlation between maybe tricking mycelium into producing fruiting bodies by just the sound vibrations of thunder, for example.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds... I'm not convinced on the face of it, but it I suppose it's possible, really, that so yeah, we might edge into you know, the arena of the supernatural here quite quickly. So I mean, the I suppose it's plausible. I don't know that there's any evidence to support this, but if you're reproducing some kind of thunderous sound, it's possible that the physical disturbance that causes in the substrate might actually stimulate pinning or the actual emergence of the fruit body. I'm not sure about this. And there are actually reports of mushroom fruiting related to lightning strikes and so forth. And again, I don't know whether this is anecdotal or not. I don't know what that mechanism would be, but yeah, I'm gonna take a pass on that one. I don't know. I don't think, as smart as mushrooms are, I don't think they're capable of discriminating between different genres of music. So I'm not going to go that far. But you never know.
That's another topic for another day.
No, it's got to be it's got to be Beethoven for shiitake, otherwise. probably not.
Oh dear. So the Buller's drop is a spore dispersal method for like all the guild fungi, but this also goes for poroid and spined mushrooms, correct?
Yes,
so
that's
something
right.
like a Ganoderma, the same thing is happening just in those tubes that you would find and on their sporulating surfaces.
Precisely. So. Yeah.
So yeah. Now I'm wondering about, what about something like a puffball or an earth star or a jelly fungus? How are these spores being distributed?
So jelly fungi use Buller's drop mechanism. What happens there is, as I described for the gills of a mushroom, but then the spores that kick themselves just you know, fractions of a millimeter above the surface of the jelly fungus fruit body, and then they're dispersed by air currents. But the other fungi that you mentioned, like puffballs, so they've actually, during their evolutionary history, they've lost this mechanism. And we know that it happened in that direction, that so they had a common ancestor, or that the ancestor of the puffballs used Buller's drop to get airborne. But puffballs have gone for a different mechanism. They're excessive in their laziness. They just allow water drops, raindrops, to impact their fruit bodies, the peridium, the skin around the spores, and this then actually acts to push the spores into the air. So you compress that bag of spores, and then you can watch the spores being spritzed from the opening at the top of the fruit body. And earth stars will do this in a very similar fashion. There's actually a ton of other mechanisms out there that are really interesting. I mean, we've got the artillery fungus that uses a fantastic mechanism, sort of like an inverted toilet plunger to fling its spore.
I think I've seen videos of that. Isn't it? It's like those little cup things you'd get as a kid, and you turn them inside out, and
exactly.
Then you fling back.
Yes. Yeah, you can use one of those kids' toys as a model for the mechanism's called snap buckling. But yeah, and that's actually got the longest range of any fungus. I mean, the artillery fungus, tiny thing, but a millimeter in diameter, and it can propel its spore mass, which is called a gleb or glebal mass, it can propel that over a distance of, or better part of, 6 meters, which is really extraordinary. What else have we got? Can think about bird's nest fungi. So they use a very sophisticated splash mechanism to get their packets of spores airborne. And then we haven't talked about all of the stinkhorns and cage fungi, these things that actually use insects as pollinators, or the equivalent of pollinators, that they create these wretched smells and they attract insects and other invertebrates to the fruit body, and then they will actually consume the spores as they consume this stinking goo, and then they'll carry the spores with them and deposit them in their feces. So yeah, lots and lots of different mechanisms of spore dispersal, and Buller was certainly one of the early mycologists that really became intrigued with these, with the biomechanics of these processes.
So when I heard you talk at Telluride about 3 years ago, I think you were talking about the hat throwing fungus, and you were talking about being able to hear it pinging against glass petri plates.
Yes, it's not a mushroom forming fungus. The hat thrower, the Pylobolus is the name. So if you believe that the zygomycetes exist, it's a zygomycete. But yeah, that has produces a stalk, and at the tip of the stalk there's a swelling, and then right on top of the swelling there's this usually blackened spore mass or sporangium. And yeah, that's squirted into the air. So the stalk is pressurized, and it acts like as a squirt gun, squirts the spore mass into the air, and that'll cover a distance of over a meter. And indeed, if you've got these growing in culture, when that thing gets going, because they're quite synchronized in their explosions, yeah, you can hear these pinging on the underside of the lid of a petri dish. Yeah, that's really impressive. Too cool. Artillery fungus too is apparently audible. Yeah.
Isn't that allegedly the fastest species, just because it can, it's the fastest moving species because it can launch its spores, and I don't know, scaled up, it's a pretty remarkable speed.
It is remarkable, and there's a lot being made of that, and some of that's probably my fault with some of the high speed work we did on Pylobolus. But there's actually other fungi that are faster. So ascomycete fungi that use an that's pressurized, and they squirt spores that are formed within that tube into the air. Some of those are moving even faster. I mean, speeds of over 100 kilometers an hour. Yeah, they're really, really fast discharge mechanisms that we find in those fungi. But I mean, there's a lot of fungi. There's a lot of fast fungi in many different parts of the fungal kingdom in terms of their movements. Yeah.
Yeah. So for all the non-mushroom forming fungi, are all of them relying on this artillery mechanism or not?
No, I mean, there's so many different mechanisms, and I've mentioned some of them, right? So there's squirt guns, there's the ascus form of that, where the spores are formed inside this structure and then squirted into the air. But there's all kinds of other mechanisms. There are some fungi that use... Oh, it's the explosive formation of a gas bubble within their stalk. This is called cavitation. And when you get this formation of this little bubble, it changes the shape of the stalk, and that pushes the spore into the air. There's just so many different mechanisms. There's probably some that we haven't discovered yet, too, that they've... the fungi have this issue of being small and producing lots of spores, and if they're going to send their genes down the great stream of time, they need to find mechanisms, they need to find ways of actually dispersing their spores from the parent in the hope, I'm being anthropomorphic here, but with the expectation that a few of those spores will find themselves on fertile ground, and then they can establish a new colony. I mean, there's no intent on the part of the fungi, but it's just that those that are effective at this are still with us, that they've been effective in transmitting their genes through time.
That's really cool. So there's a ton of spores in our atmosphere. We already went over the numbers, and it's pretty astonishing. There's so many different ways that spores can enter our atmosphere from all these different mechanisms that we just went over. And one of the theories that I heard you talking about at Telluride a few years ago was how fungi are great rainmakers. And because we were talking about how hydrophilic these spores are, could you tell our listeners about how spores could be making clouds?
So it's a good question, and there's no direct evidence that it works in this way. And all we suggested in the work that we published a few years ago was that they could be contributing to the formation of water droplets in clouds. The dynamics of water movement within clouds is very, very difficult to study. Atmospheric chemists do things like they fly airplanes through clouds and they use lasers to obtain information about the size of water droplets in clouds and so forth. But it's possible, it's conceivable, given the vast numbers of fungal spores that are in the atmosphere, particularly above certain parts of the landmass, that they could at least be contributing to the formation of raindrops. So this process, could they be, since they're actually, they do this on their surface, since they drive the formation of the condensation of water, if there's enough of these particles in a cloud, then absolutely this seems plausible that they could be playing some role. I mean, to some degree, any particulates within, or many kinds of particulates within a cloud, will contribute to the formation of water droplets. But it's the way that the fungal spores do this in such a controlled and directed fashion, at least when we study them in the lab, it seems plausible that they could be operating in this fashion.
So I've heard of bacteria being useful in biological precipitation, or bioprecipitation, as it's called. And really, I've heard of bacteria on the surface of plants. And when wind sweeps up the bacteria, or when water droplets evaporate into the atmosphere, ice crystals form around them, and water molecules clump onto the crystals, making them bigger and bigger, and eventually forming into rain, snow, and fall back to the ground. Do you think that bacteria and fungi work together in this bioprecipitation cycle?
Well, I think they're part of this whole process. They're part of the bacteria and fungi both influence the condensation of water within the atmosphere. And the work that you're referring to on these bacteria, they're referred to as ice nucleating bacteria, and a lot of those processes are occurring quite high in the atmosphere at colder temperatures, where indeed ice can form, and that effect is really well established. What we're thinking about with mushroom spores is that these are activities that are occurring at lower elevations, so sort of just above the forest canopy in a tropical ecosystem, for example, where indeed very high concentrations of spores have been detected. But yeah, I suppose, I mean, yes, I think your point's a good one, that there are a number of different particles of biological origin that can be perhaps contributing to rainfall. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how much of a difference in rainfall do you think a single sporulating mushroom is making? I mean, if these spores don't end up germinating and living on the land, they're either like in our lungs or other beings' lungs, or still kind of floating around. So
just falling back to the ground. I mean, an individual mushroom is not going to be particularly effective at changing anything other than its immediate, you know, local environment. But again, it's plausible when you have millions, hundreds of millions of fruit bodies all contributing tens of thousands of spores a second, you know, to the, not to the atmosphere, but to the air around them, that this could have an effect upon local weather conditions. I mean, after that paper was published, I got some phone calls from people that said, well, you know, if we cultivate mushrooms in this very arid area, do you think it's actually going to promote rainfall? And no, I think it's probably going to stay pretty dry in Las Vegas for a year with or without mushroom beds. But give it a try.
Yeah.
Hope springs eternal, right?
But, definitely.
Yeah.
So perhaps we can move on to your work with taxonomy. I read your essay Against the Naming of Fungi, and you were talking about pleomorphism and how it led to a lot of confusion among mycologists. Do you want to talk a bit more about that paper? Well,
I mean, historically, the fact that fungi are so plastic in their development, right, that they'll produce multiple different spore-producing structures within a larger life cycle. And this historically, then, this led mycologists to describe what we might regard as a single species on, you know, multiple times. And so this has certainly led to some confusion in the taxonomic literature for the fungi. But I mean, using molecular techniques today, we can get around that problem. We're not basing our descriptions purely on the appearance of the fungus or the appearance of spores under a microscope. That this does give us a richer view of biological diversity. But the point really that I was trying to make in that paper is that the description of a fungal species is still so subjective that it's not really we're not really applying the biological species concept that we might apply to larger animals or to insects perhaps with the fungi, that this is still a human construct, that we're going to call this thing a species and we're going to say based upon some level of genetic difference from this next culture collection that we're dealing with separate species. But the evidence for this is rather weak. I mean, we do it for reasons of convenience. We need to put names to things, or at least numbers to things, to be able to describe what we're studying. But I think there's an awful there's the appearance of certainty when we talk about the number of fungal species, for example, the number of described fungal species, which I think is unwarranted by the actual scientific data. I don't know if I'm making this very clear, but it's a species is in the eye of a beholder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is it that actually says that this is a variety of Ammonita muscaria rather than a different species? I mean, we just don't really have that information. So I think I was speaking to what I see as the chaos within the taxonomic literature. But I mean, it's a very, very human impulse to actually put things in categories and put names to things so we can begin to try and make sense of nature. But I also think it's actually particularly futile.
Yeah, it does seem a bit arbitrary. And, you know, what is the criteria exactly that's separating this from that? And I, like, personally have tried to find definitions for all the fungal phyla, and that was such difficult research, and no one's in a consensus. It's definitely chaotic. And
there's a tremendous amount of chaos, and I think it's I have an issue with this too. At a time when we're destroying the biosphere, it also seems rather futile to be describing species and making sure based on some particular criterion, you know, how many species of fungi there are. This seems rather wasteful. I don't know why we're doing this. Is this so that we might inscribe some tablets and leave them for the aliens to really show? You know, they're going to come here and say, boy, look at all the stuff they destroyed. I don't see the justification for this. So yeah, I wrote a series of essays, and that was one of the essays that got me some very irate emails. But there you go. Such is life if you're a contrarian.
Yeah, one funny joke that I heard is how many mycologists does it take to change a light bulb? It's 100. One to change the light bulb, 99 to argue what Latin name it is.
Oh dear.
You'll have lots of systematists that will disagree with that viewpoint, but I think if you look at the essay that I wrote, I think most of what I say in that essay has stood up over time. I haven't seen any really compelling critiques of the logic that I tried to set out in that essay.
So we grow Cordyceps militaris, Cordyceps species, and we have found that there's another type of fungi inside, and Calcosporium cordycepiticola is the name. And if we leave the mature mushroom out or raise the temperature over like 75 degrees Fahrenheit, this other fungi comes out. And do you think that this Calcosporium cordycepiticola could be an anamorph of Cordyceps militaris? We haven't found much of any literature on it.
No, that's really interesting. I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware of that specific. If it is I'm not aware of that relationship. It sounds absolutely fascinating that you've got this. Is it a different expression of the same? I mean, there's obviously a way of looking at this. You could actually isolate the two different types of tissue and actually, amplify their DNA and actually see if you're looking at, see if these are discrete, if these are different individuals at least. Yeah, really interesting. I mean, it speaks to the fact that everything is a symbiosis. Most things are mutualisms, right?
Right. And this is kind of a complicated topic with a lot of cordyceps, ophiocordyceps, like ophiocordyceps senescens. That has been definitely a topic of debate from a lot of people of what exactly is it? And, you know, when researchers started to isolate and tried to clone ophiocordyceps senescens, they were cloning all sorts of other fungi out of the caterpillar mushroom complex, and they're finding hundreds of different types of fungi.
Wow.
And so it was like, what are we calling Ophiocordyceps senescens, and what actually is it? And what is Paedomyces hepiale? What are these fungi, and how can we call, you know, what are the names of these different things? How are they acting? So it's definitely interesting.
This will happen. So when the aliens, I'm obviously in touch with them, but when they come back next and take me away for analysis, right? Maybe they'll put me in a blender and they'll pull out all kinds of DNA, right? They'll pull out
right.
maternal and paternal DNA within my nuclei, but they're also going to pull out my microbiome and all of the genetic riches within my gut and elsewhere. I mean, and they're going to say, well, what are we really looking at here? We're looking at a community. We're not looking at an individual. How interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It does make me second guess, like, mushrooms. And if you were to take a single filament of hyphae from all these different pieces, would you be getting the exact same genetics? It's just an interesting question.
It's really interesting. Yeah. And, I suppose, particularly when you're dealing with in your business, when you're obviously looking at the identity of the organism from which maybe you're extracting your putatively medicinal compounds, it's very important to actually know what organism or organisms you're working with. That's really interesting. It adds just another layer of complexity to that whole issue. Mm-hmm.
So you've written a lot of books, and I was hoping you could kind of give a short synopsis of them. One that really stuck out to me was Carpet Monsters and Killer Spores, A Natural History of the Toxic Mold. What can readers expect to learn in your book?
Yeah, I mean, that was some, I mean, I've been writing books now for well, almost 20 years, 18 years or so. The Carpet Monsters book really was it's an interesting project because it was driven by, there was so much interest in the United States in the phenomenon of toxic mold and the idea that this black mold, Stachybotrys, was then called Stachybotrys chartarum, that was plaguing homes and killing children, and this was hyped in the media, but there was also a lot of money to be made by attorneys that would be suing all kinds of different people, suing landlords, suing building contractors and so forth for actually engaging in practices that promoted mold growth within homes, and then homeowners could actually sue to recover damages based on mold exposure. But that's pretty interesting issue, and it's still an important one today, although there's certainly a lot less money to be made by attorneys because there are mold exclusions that are written into all of the insurance policies for homeowners and for all buildings. And so you can't really collect directly on the appearance of mold in a home. You can collect for water damage. So I was actually involved in this usually as a witness for the defense in different cases. This is a good few years ago now, actually. So I was ending up defending people like building contractors and landlords based on my understanding of the riskiness or lack thereof associated with mold exposure. Because the only thing we really know about mold exposure within buildings is that breathing in lots of fungal spores in a water-damaged building can exacerbate symptoms of asthma, another allergic disease. And the problem is back then that people were claiming all kinds of ailments were actually caused by mold exposure, which I suppose is plausible, but it's the science isn't there. And so as a scientist, that's my role, is to talk about, you know, when is evidence-based claims rather than hype and wishful thinking and lawyering.
Right.
So what about your latest book titled The Selfish Ape, Human Nature and Our Path to Extinction? That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so I'm a recovering mycologist. That's the way I describe myself now. Hello, my name is Professor Nicholas Money. I'm a recovering mycologist. Because as I said when we started out, I mean, I started out at 18 years old being fascinated by fungi and then studying fungal biology for so long, and I'm 57 years old now, and there are other things I think to be interested in. And what I'm trying to do is actually...
Are you sure?
No, maybe not. No, fair enough. Well, I'm exploring those other things, right? I'm exploring other topics, but I've become very, very interested in other aspects of biology. And so this book, The Selfish Ape, it deals with our biology, but it's certainly informed by what I learned about nature through studying fungi for so long. I mean, fungi and humans, we play by precisely the same evolutionary rules. And I have a fairly bleak view of the future of Homo sapiens. So I'm trying to make sense of that in this book, but also to say why, in evolutionary terms, why we've ended up in this place. And I think, in a sense, the fact that we've done so much damage to the biosphere is inevitable. I think as soon as we migrated from Africa, as soon as we poured from the Rift Valley, things, it was downhill after that propitious moment in the history of Earth. But so there we go. That's what I'm looking at.
So you've been studying mycology for a really long time. Is there any projects that you worked on or any research that you collaborated with or done yourself that you felt like was the highlight of your career, was the most exciting, interesting, or any projects that you have are currently working on or about to work on that you're super excited for was the most interesting?
Oh, that's really, yeah, that's a great question. I suppose in the end, just because of the drama of these mechanisms of spore discharge, I think those were some of the most exciting experiments that we did when we were actually, for the first time, able to, using high-speed cameras, see how these movements were actually achieved, actually see things that no human had ever seen. It'd be impossible to see things that are happening within, you know, a few microseconds of action, but actually seeing these movements on the screen, on the computer screen, absolutely, yeah, that was really awe-inspiring. That would sometimes provoke tears or certainly laughter. It's just, yeah, that was really interesting. I think probably some of the most technically, the most difficult stuff I did actually was 20 years ago, really, when I came up with a method for measuring the tiny forces exerted by individual fungal hyphae. So that's something that hadn't been done before.
What?
And when we got that to work for the first time, that was explosively, that was exhilarating. Yeah.
So you were looking at fossils from individual hyphae?
No, what we were doing was growing individual, I don't know how I phrase that. So we were looking at individual hyphal tips, right? So individual microscopic filaments. And I figured out a mechanism where we could allow them to push against a very, very sensitive beam, which is actually, we can refer to them as a strain gauge or a force transducer. And these were such sensitive instruments, and we developed the electronics that we could actually detect these tiny, tiny movements that the fungus was actually causing as it pushed against these little silicon beams. It was very, very neat. And that was enlightening. I think that work was, yeah, that was pretty good. Those were interesting days in the lab when we actually got that to work. And I've always found those kind of experiments where we're actually interacting physically with these microorganisms, those are really, really intriguing and very gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that it just became, over the course of the couple of years we were developing these methods, that it became routine that we could measure how much oomph these individual hyphae were exerting. That was really neat. Yeah, interesting question.
Did you study different types of species of hyphae? I know some mushrooms have the power to break through concrete, so I'm just curious. I'm sure different hyphae have different pushing power. I don't know if you studied different species.
So we studied a broad range of different fungi, and then we also looked at water molds, so things like Phytophthora, the potato blight fungus, but it's not a fungus, right? It's a stromenopile. It's an oomycete. So these water molds, and we studied them because their hyphae are quite big. That's where we started, but we ended up looking at a whole range of different fungi. The phenomenon that you refer to with breaking concrete or pushing through asphalt, which is indeed something an individual or a group of fruit bodies of mushrooms can do, we actually looked at that too. So we used we used larger strain gauges there to actually look at the power of single fruit bodies as they emerged, and that was interesting work too. I mean, what you're looking at there is just the combined action of hundreds of thousands or sometimes potentially millions of hyphae that are all pushing at the same time and therefore exerting this pressure over a larger macroscopic area, and then are able to push their way through these sorts of obstacles. But yeah, that was a really interesting project. There are all kinds of fungi that are fungi that penetrate plant leaves. So these are plant pathogens, and they're also capable of exerting, so it appears, very large forces to actually push through the cuticle and the underlying epidermal cell on a leaf. And that's still an area of active research in a number of labs.
So if you had the chance to do any research and answer any question, lingering question in mycology, I'm sure, you know, there's a lot. Or if you would like to see any research done by any other individuals besides yourself, what do you think is the main kind of burning question that you have and you want answered in the field of mycology?
Wow, these are great questions. That's a good question. And one question or a series of questions that intrigues me, I suppose it's not of any global significance, is actually thinking about the way that this Buller's drop mechanism works. So even though we can claim, or we might claim that we've solved the mechanism, that's not even close to the truth, really. The way that a mushroom and mushroom spores can coordinate this process, the way that they can actually control that, the secretion of mannitol onto their surface and perhaps other compounds, there's so much about this that we don't understand. So when I actually got out of that kind of lab research, there were a whole series of questions that were unanswered about the way that this worked, and that would be really, really, really fascinating. But there's a ton of questions, fascinating questions about related to mushroom development too, which is thinking about the genetic control of mushroom development. We don't know much about that at all, really. I mean, how is it that a mushroom formed by, let's call it a particular species, how is it that fruiting body of a fly agaric always has these series of immediately identifiable characteristics? How is that buried in the genome of that organism, and how is that structure expressed? I think that's fascinating, the fact that a fly agaric produces a fly agaric, and a witch's cap produces a witch's cap. That to me is absolutely fascinating. There's a lot of questions there in I suppose, questions of developmental biology applied to the fungi. But there's really very few labs that are working on this, specifically looking at how fruit bodies develop.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I didn't know that there was this deficiency in understanding the genome.
So,
there's obviously a ton of work on fungal genomes, but in terms of actually relating to the expression of genes to the development of mushrooms, boy, there's right. that study is in its infancy.
Wow.
So you've written 7 books and lots of papers, and I'm sure your research is sprawled across the web, but I'm just for
sprawled,
our listeners.
That sounds pejorative, doesn't it? Sprawled like some kind of toxic leak. I've actually written more than that in terms of books, some
oh, better great.
Than others, but yes, you can if you go on consult my website, themycologist.com, and you'll see the literary riches that have poured from this.
Nice URL. That was a catch. So themycologist.com?
Yes.
Yep.
Perfect. So we have one final question that we ask all of our guests that come on our show. And this is also open for our listeners, and we would love to hear from you of your answer. And the question goes, if all fungi could talk and they had the microphone and they could speak 1 to 2 sentences to the whole human race, what do you think they would say?
You are a bunch of tremendous narcissists, and we can't wait till you're gone. You selfish apes! You selfish apes!
You're on the path to extinction.
We'll keep on flourishing just fine. We will outlive you by an eternity.
Yep, I wholeheartedly concur with that statement.
Been here long before us, and they will be long after. So
I think so. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our show. I really appreciate all the wisdom that you shared with us and our listeners. It's been
pleasure talking with both of you. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and everyone check out themycologist.com. There's a lot of awesome PDFs and essays that you can access and read and see some electron footage of Buller's drop and more. So, yeah.
Okay, very good.
All right, so that concludes another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast. Stay tuned, stay shroomed, much love, and may the spores be with you.